perfect.
Your host, Joe Montaldo.
Good evening, wherever you are in our beautiful blue planet. Like Natasha says, I'm your host, Joe Montaldo. Today's guest is going to be Neil deGrasse Tyson. Actually, I've been watching him for a very, very, very long time. He's an astrophysicist. He's a fantastic writer, ladies and gentlemen. He has several books out. We're going to be talking about the Pluto Files today. But really and truly, in a few minutes, I'm going to get y'all to, I'm going to get him to describe some of his other books, too, later on in the show, so y'all can know where to find him, what to do. There's also a video series, which I don't know if it's still available, but I'll ask him about that in a few minutes and see where it is. Now, right now, you're currently working for the history, for the American Museum of History, right? Natural History.
Yeah, the American Museum of Natural History of New York City.
Now, you're not the curator there, right? You're just an astrophysicist? Because someone had told me you were curator, and I wanted to clear that up right off the bat.
Well, in research museums, what they call their scientists is curators.
Oh, okay.
So a curator is to a museum what a professor is at a university.
Oh, okay. Well, now I'm a moron.
Yeah, so there's assistant, associate, full curator, and the like. And now, but I carry the title of director of the Hayden Planetarium, as well as I'm an astrophysicist in the Department of Astrophysics here.
Yeah, because I noticed the Hayden. I think they had mentioned about the Hayden Planetarium in there as well, and I was getting ready to mention that, which is interesting. Now, let me ask you this. What made you decide to pick on poor Pluto?
I didn't pick on it. It had it coming, first of all. Whatever that happened to it, it had it coming. We, in the year 2000, we opened a brand-new exhibit, a very expensive exhibit,
mm-hmm.
where we sort of rethought how we should present cosmic knowledge to the public in the newly built Rose Center for Earth and Space. And in there, when we got to the solar system, we realized that new icy bodies had been found in the outer solar system, with orbits kind of similar to that of Pluto and objects of similar composition as Pluto. And so we figured, why not group Pluto with those other objects in our exhibit? And why not, while we're at it, let's group the gas giants together, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And let's lump the rocky, dense planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, together. So the family photo of the solar system was not the enumeration of the planets. It was a collection of objects of similar properties. And it took a year, but eventually, the fact that we did this landed a page one story in the New York Times with the title, Pluto Not a Planet? Only in New York.
Only in New York.
And that's when my life went to hell, because I started getting hate mail from like colleagues and even third graders who had just learned about the nine planets and spent so much time memorizing them, and somehow I had disrupted the stability of their life.
Well, I can kind of understand. I mean, I've always kind of wondered about Pluto even from as a small child. I mean, it's not even the size of our moon, isn't it?
Exactly. There's seven moons, in fact, bigger than Pluto. And Pluto, we've known for some time now, didn't really fit in with anybody else's properties. But you can't have a class of one in science. So as long as Pluto was alone out there, you just kind of grandfathered it in and say, okay, Pluto, you don't look like anybody else, but we'll take you along. And so now we have this other region of the solar system recently populated by icy bodies, recently unpopulated in our knowledge. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's been there since the beginning. And so I see it as not the solar system losing Pluto. I see it as our knowledge of the solar system gaining a new swath of real estate out there called the Kuiper Belt, Kuiper Belt of comets,
yeah.
Named for a famous astronomer mid-century, Gerard Kuiper, who predicted there'd be this reservoir of icy bodies that were not sort of gravitationally vacuumed up by a planet out there, because there isn't a large planet out there at all. And it's the leftovers from the early solar system.
I always get it confused with the Oort cloud. Oort cloud's farther out, though, isn't it?
Oort cloud is much, much farther out, and it completely surrounds the solar system.
Yeah.
The Kuiper Belt is a flattened region, still kind of puffy, but nonetheless flattened region, that surrounds the sun beyond Neptune.
Okay. Yeah, because I was wondering about that. It's once we pass Pluto, I know there's not all that much knowledge out there. I know there's some, and I was surprised when they started talking about these other icy bodies. I mean, wasn't one of them almost the size of Pluto, or half the size of Pluto?
Exactly. And so, in fact, that's what brought the question: if there's another body out there that's icy that you would never have called a planet, but you'd learn that it's bigger than Pluto. Well, then what does that say about Pluto?
Yeah.
And so it's these kinds of discoveries that created things that make you go, how should we resolve this? And so even though we were the first to publicly rethink Pluto's status, 6 years later, in a meeting of the International Astronomical Union, it's not a labor union in that sense, it's just a society, an organization, mm-hmm. took a vote and officially demoted Pluto to dwarf planet status.
I hate to hate on him for it, because really and truly it needed to be there. it's true. I mean, you know, when I hear people, because I've heard quite a few people get mad about this, and
all emotional, all up in your face about it, too.
But then, you know, a friend of mine reminded me originally Pluto was Planet X, and quite a few people got mad when they changed it from Planet X to Pluto, and I was like...
Yeah, Planet X, in fact, Pluto was thought to be the Planet X, but mm-hmm. after it was discovered, it was clearly not. It didn't have enough mass to do what it needed Planet X to be doing.
Yeah, I stay away from that Planet X. It gets me in trouble all the time. I just stay away from it. Well, I have just issues with other planets and anything passing through the solar system or crossing the ecliptic. I just have issues
mm-hmm.
with. Well, especially that I know we have that asteroid belt and we have the Kuiper belt and then we have the Oort cloud. I would figure any large mass moving around out there should be moving something around with it, or something should be detecting it. Isn't Planet X supposed to be, what, 4 or 5 times the size of Planet
X? No, there's no Planet X anymore.
Well, yeah, I know. I'm just saying. But
oh, at the time,
yeah.
People imagined that Planet X was an object about commensurate mass to that of Neptune.
Mm, okay, which is fairly big.
Yeah, fairly big.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, so you got to talking about this. Now, poor third graders hating on you. That's just...
I know, that's bad. I'd be like public enemy even among school children, you know.
I know. If they're watching Nova, they know you're a good guy and you do good.
I would hope so.
Now, you know, there was a series. I originally had seen this. I actually had got it, part of it, at the library. Where was it? I forgot the name of it. I wanted to ask you about it if it's still available today. It was a video lecture series you had done.
Oh, that's still out there. Yeah,
oh,
thanks for noticing that. For the teaching company,
yeah.
Which combs the nation and looks on campuses of all kinds, finding sort of professors of sort of high repute or high lecture mm-hmm. Value, because every campus has got the list of professors that you know you have to take, right?
Yeah,
even if they're not heard of outside of the campus, they're definitely heard of within the campus. So they've created a business model of finding these star professors and inviting them to give their courses to the general public, but through you see them through these DVDs. And so I was invited to do it, and I said, I don't have time to give a whole lecture. So I gave just like 12 lectures. Most people give 60 or 80 full years worth of a course that you would take. I said, I just can't do it. So I gave a 12 lectures, and they're called My Favorite Universe, and they're just handpicked my favorite subjects. And it's still out there, the teaching company.
Well, the first time I had seen this was actually at my local library had it.
Good.
You could actually get it, which surprised me, because they got a lot of stuff at the local library, but usually it's not good stuff. It's usually stuff you don't want to look at.
Uh-huh.
I'll be honest with you. But
where's your local library? What town?
New Orleans.
New Orleans, right.
Yeah,
okay.
We actually have a huge library, one of the nice things about down here is we have Tulane University, and they
right,
actually...
Right, so that sets a standard there.
Yeah, and so when we get down there, they have all your work down there. Now, when you get out into the suburbs and all, it's a little different. We have huge libraries, but they house in different materials because, frankly, a lot of these people down here are just in another world somewhere.
Right, right.
They're, and physics...
Oh, the universe.
Yeah, and physics is, you know, for a lot of people, is not something they can actually wrap their heads around. And but I enjoyed it. And most of the people, the first time I read Stephen Hawking's Universe in a Nutshell, I was kind of at loss, but
mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. And I've actually, now I kind of understand it a lot better than I did way back when, but I'm also a lot older now, too.
Right.
Now,
and wiser, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully wise. mm-hmm. I'm working on it.
Older doesn't always mean you think better.
Yeah.
You have to say older and wiser.
Yeah, I'm working on it hot and heavy. I see you have quite a few books to your credit, though, now. Death by a Black Hole, I want to go back and talk about Pluto some more, too, but when I seen this, Death by a Black Hole, I must not have seen this or read this one, because I found that interesting in itself. Now, are you referring to the black hole at the center of our solar system, or...
It wouldn't matter, just any black hole at all.
Any huge black hole?
Any black hole at all. You'll die the same way, falling in.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're going to be disintegrated and compressed into nothing.
Yeah, it's just a matter of whether you die before you cross the event horizon or after, but you'll die the same way.
Now, you know, I'm glad, because you're an astrophysicist.
Mm-hmm.
A couple quick questions on a sidetrack you hear. Now, you know, I hear people all the time talking, planet Earth's got 3.3 billion years before our sun goes red dwarf. That's all fine, but... Alpha Centauri?
It's closer to 5 billion years, but go on.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
But isn't Alpha Centauri...
So rest, you can rest more more peacefully. It's 5 billion, not 3.
but I was thinking one of the nearby galaxies were due to run into us much sooner than our sun.
No, we're scheduled to collide with the Andromeda galaxy.
Okay, Andromeda.
A huge galaxy just outside of ours. It's 2 million light years away. That'll happen maybe in 6 or 7 billion years.
Oh, okay, okay.
Later than when when we lose our sun.
Now, that's what I wanted to know, because I couldn't tell which one it was. And now, here's something else I wanted to ask you, and I've never been able to authenticate this anywhere. But I had seen this on a science special on Science Discovery about a year ago, talking about there was evidence that another galaxy may have deposited this section, the planets in this section of our galaxy here. And I've never seen anything else on it, and I've never heard anybody of any credible talk about this. So I said, well, you know, I'll ask Dr. Tyson. Maybe he knows, or maybe...
Well, there's a cottage industry of people who worry about galaxy collisions,
mm-hmm.
which are rather common. In fact, most galaxies would have had at least one collision in their lives. Many galaxies are surrounded by dwarf galaxies, and this is an unstable situation. The dwarf galaxy will eventually get ripped apart and plunge into the main galaxy. It's kind of like galactic cannibalism when one eats the other and there's no trace of the other one left. And so there are people who have studied stars that were at one point sort of stretched apart, but who still follow the same trajectory, like a train, like cars in a train, one right after another as they plunge through the galaxy that ate them. So in other words, if we're the Milky Way and there's a little dwarf galaxy orbiting us, eventually that galaxy will collide with us, but its stars will still have sort of speeds that are the same as the other stars. So there are people looking for what they call coherence in the velocities of objects. And when they find a whole stream of stars that have the same velocity, all headed in the same direction, you turn the clock back and you hypothesize that these were all part of a galaxy that collided with their own.
See, that kind of stuff just fascinates me beyond belief.
Right? Yeah, yeah, it's remarkable stuff.
Well, because I get to thinking about, you know, if, you know, one day we may find life out in our galaxy, and I start thinking, well, did this galaxy bring life, or this one, or that one, or where did the seeds actually... Because, you know, there's a big discussion on where humans come from, and on a regular basis, you know, where the seeds of life come from, and I'm still kind of with the panspermia crowd, but
mm-hmm.
I'm going to hang with them for a while long until somebody comes up with something better.
Panspermia is good.
Yeah, it's good. It's a solid, you know, building mm-hmm. blocks of life coming from space, delivered by, you know, comets and asteroids and meteors and stuff like that. I can deal with that, but see, for me, that suggests that life is plentiful in the galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I don't mean plentiful with that every planet you find is going to have life, or even for that matter, every solar system. But what are we currently at? 200 billion stars in our
plus or minus.
Yeah,
you know, in the hundreds of billions.
So that puts
that's just in our own Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah, that's just in our own Milky Way.
There's 100 billion other galaxies.
Yeah, which just drives everything the numbers much higher. But I was just thinking, with that many stars, and you know, there's got to be close to a trillion planets out there, I'm sure. Got to be some other life out there somewhere. Whether or not it's more or less intelligent than us, that's anybody's bet. But I just can't see it not being out there. If the building blocks are brought here by asteroids and comets, I would think that it would be, as long as the conditions are right, I would think the norm would be life, not the other way around.
Well, it's not clear. We do know. I mean, in the old days, we imagined life requiring a 72-degree room temperature pond.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know that there are entire branches of life in the tree of life that thrive under conditions that would just kill humans instantly. Conditions of high pressure, low pressure, high temperature, low pressure, low temperature, radiation, dehydration. There are microbes, bacteria in particular, that thrive under exotic conditions. So realizing that, and that's just happening here on Earth, imagine how many more places in the galaxy that life can form.
That just fascinates me, because I had seen the other day there was a release on Mars about the Northern Cap being 95% pure water. One of the French groups put it out. And I found that really, really, really interesting.
Yeah, the ice cap, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The ice cap, being 95% pure. And then they were talking about what appeared at one time to be upswellings coming up from what was probably liquid water depositing minerals on the surface. And, you know, they get to speculating a lot, and it is speculation when they start talking about, you know, micro or biological, any type of microbe-type life.
Well, anytime you find liquid water, you're tempted to ask, is there life?
Yeah, well, and so, you know, when I first started getting involved with watching Mars, I've always been fascinated with Mars, but we were so far away that everybody's like, oh, there's no way there's any could ever be life there. There's probably not water there. There's all Now we've completely gone the other way. You know, we found methane on Mars. We found what appears to be liquid water on Mars. We know there's pure water on Mars. We know there is some heat there. So, you know, it's becoming more and more possible every day that there's some type of life. I'm not saying there's intelligent life on Mars, and if there was, I have no idea. But it is looking more and more possible, like we're going to find some type of life on Mars.
And, exactly. And I agree 100%.
And I have heard, you know, other scientists talking about, you know, other planetoids in the body like Europa and other places like that, and Io and a few other places that we may eventually find, you know, life there as well. When you start thinking about, what is there, 100 and something planets and planetoids in our solar system?
Solar system? Well, there's the eight planets, and then there's 100,000 asteroids and likely hundreds of thousands of Kuiper Belt objects.
Yeah, and I was thinking, what is there, like 40 moons? Or no, I mean, there's 40 moons.
Jupiter's got 40.
Moons,
I've lost count, but there's probably 100 moons in the solar system.
Yeah. Well, I was just thinking, I mean, if you find life on four or five places, including Earth and our own solar system.
That's an extraordinary statistic.
Yeah, that really drives everything up across the galaxy immensely. And it gets a little strange, but... You know, it just fascinates me because, for me, I honestly can't believe we're the only thing in the galaxy, and I would like to think we're the most intelligent thing in the galaxy, even though that could be argued right here at home. But, I mean, I would like to think that.
That assumes we're intelligent at all.
Yeah. But judging from the age of other stars and other solar systems, it makes me wonder if there's not something out there much older and much wiser than us. But I don't see why they wouldn't bother with us, because we're kind of backwards at this point. But we're learning. I mean, honestly, Dr. Tyson, we're learning every day. We're becoming a little bit smarter, and hopefully a lot smarter over the next 100 years, and hopefully a lot of things will get a lot better here soon, but I guess we'll have to wait on that. But, you know, the life has always fascinated me off the planet, you know. Now, I wanted to ask you, I know you had heard about George Bush's space program, and I think President Obama is going to pretty much stay along these lines with the space program. About, you know, setting up a base on the moon and then eventually putting a colony on Mars. What do you think? I mean, is this a good idea, waste of money? I'm just curious. I like to get a lot of opinions on this.
Well, I think the answer is simple. If you wear just a pure scientist's hat, then there is no reason to ever send people, because you could send 20 separate other missions to do for the same money that it would have taken to send a person. Even the most diehard geologist who would love to bounce around on the lunar or Martian surface with a rock hammer would, when given the option, surely take the 20 missions or 50 missions that it would be.
Yeah, if he's in it for science.
Which
yeah.
Totaled would equal the cost of one mission where you send a person. So that's an unquestionable fact. The difference is, it's often that the scientific community, and my colleagues and I are occasionally to blame for this, we think of NASA as a private science funding agency, and so that when NASA spends money on a manned program, we cry foul, when in fact the history of NASA's funding has always been about the manned program.
Yeah.
The science has ridden its coattails. The science has piggybacked the broader geopolitical mission statement of NASA.
Well, I agree wholeheartedly. If this is going to be all about science, and I think unmanned is the way to go, but I think NASA also serves a purpose to inspire our youth and our country. And as much as I'm inspired by even the rovers on the surface of Mars, for young people, it's seeing somebody walk on the surface of Mars is going to be a much bigger inspiration. So I can see it both ways. So I'm kind of in the middle. I think we should have a manned program, but I think we should really do more probes and a much bigger unmanned program first. I really think if we're going to establish any type of colony on Mars anytime in the near future, in the next 100 years or so, I think we really need to do a lot more exploration of Mars, not involving humans.
No one will deny that. I think in the end, it's the manned program that will get the larger share of the money. And so there's all this talk of the unmanned probes sort of there for reconnaissance, establishing base camp, and delivering material, food, water in advance so that the astronauts themselves don't have to then bring a year worth of supplies with them.
Yeah, I know that was a couple of the ones they had talked about with sending probes and unmanned. You know, basically getting everything set up with automated systems long before we get
there. Long before, exactly.
Sending food, having it making oxygen, having it making different types of fuels, which is all stuff we can do remote control. These are not technologies that are that all that far beyond what we possess today. Now, my thing is how we're going to get there and get back. And 9 months in space is a long time for anybody. And
That's only getting there.
That's what I'm saying. That's only a one-way trip, yeah.
Yeah, then you have to wait for the Earth and Mars to line up again, so it's another, you know, it's a three-year round-trip mission.
Yeah, you're going to spend 9 months each way and at least a year on the surface, and that's a long time to be away from home, and it's a long time to be out in space, and just the sheer amount of radiation in space is going to be... That's why I say we should do as much exploring as we can. I think we should have a manned program because I want to inspire the youth of this country, because we need to get a much better science program going in this country with our youth. But I do think practically, if we're going to do this right, that we need to do a lot more unmanned missions first.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there was they were talking about the big rover. They were going to send that big rover over there, the one that could do like 30 clicks on and really do some cruising.
Right.
I haven't heard what happened to that, though.
Well, that's the... Well, there are the rovers that are there now, and then there's the Mars Science Laboratory,
mm-hmm.
which would be sort of mobile laboratory, which is highly tricked out with the kind of things it can do.
No, because, you know, really, at this point, I think that we're fairly satisfied with what we found on Mars. I think we're going to be pleasantly surprised by other things that we find on Mars. And I understand the need to explore, and I do understand the need that, you know, there's 6 billion people on this planet, and in 100 years or 150 years, there's going to be 12 billion people on this planet. And I do understand we need room to expand, but I really think we need to take our time and do it right, and not just waste money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I hate to say it, but I see a lot of money get wasted in the space program, and I would rather see it redirected to something that would, you know, serve a better purpose. Because I'm all for deep space exploration. I really think it's the way to inspire the youth, and the technologies we get from it to help advance our society. So I'm always for that.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I'm hoping somewhere along the line someone will get lucky and run into ET out there. And say, hey, look what we found.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I've heard some good stuff about mining the asteroid belt. I don't know how plausible that is right now, but I've heard some.
Well, it's good if you brought it to another location, but not back to Earth's surface.
Yeah.
It's not economical to do.
Somebody was talking about Zone L11, building a platform in Zone L11, and using it as a launching platform to Mars and bringing the asteroids there to be mined.
Oh, could it be L2, not L11?
Maybe it is. Maybe
probably L2. There are five Lagrangian points. These are places where the net force of gravity at those spots is zero.
That might be where it is, and I'd have to look.
All the gravity cancels out, and so you can just deposit stuff and leave it there, and then assemble it later. It's not going to drift away.
That's just going to hang out in that. Well, that's excellent. See, that would be the thing to do, and then they could do all their little work right there, and it'd be safe to keep it away from our planet, because I know there's a lot of radiation in space, but I'm still a little leery about bringing big rocks over here. You know, for a couple of reasons. One, they might fall out of the sky. Two, they might actually be containing something we don't want on our planet.
Well, there's an entire branch of NASA called the Planetary Protection Group
mm-hmm.
that worries about cross-contamination from one planetary object to another, planetary surface.
I know there used to be a law. NASA actually had a law that was, the Article 1280, I can't remember what it is, but they used to have a law. If you found anything extraterrestrial that you couldn't touch it. It even had a fine up to $5,000 and 10 years in jail. And I know a lot of the people try to play this off as NASA was hiding ET secrets, but this was about if something fell out of the sky or landed in your backyard, they didn't want you messing with it. And that's all this was. I mean, Article 1218, I'll have to look it up. I'll send you a copy of it one day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a real interesting thing that it was passed as a bill in the early 70s, and I think it was repealed in 1997, if I'm correct, but it was interesting. And first time somebody sent it to me, I was like, "What is this?" But then I realized what it was for. I mean, NASA was basically covering their butt, so if somebody found a rock that was contaminated, they wouldn't sue them. that's what it was. I mean, I don't want anybody to take it out of context and start saying that NASA's keeping alien secrets or something, because they will. I'll be getting all kind of emails about, I didn't know NASA did that kind of stuff. I don't know what NASA does and what NASA knows.
Well, I don't, like I said, I've never heard of it, this rule, and so...
Yeah, it was, but I'll, when I find it, I'll actually have Linda send you an email.
Okay.
I got it in one of my favorites list on one of these computers in here, and because somebody had sent it to me, it was quite a long time ago, and I just found it fascinating. I thought it was kind of funny, but it was kind of fascinating as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing for me out there... The fact that there's going to be other life in the galaxy is one of the more fascinating things. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Drake Equation. What is your opinion on it? I mean, plausible, way off, close?
It's just a way to organize our ignorance about the search for life. I mean, it's a fascinating way to think about the problem of the search for life, and it's not a you know, that's it. You don't. It's not something to have an argument about.
Yeah, I agree.
It's just if life out there is like life here, then this equation will allow you to estimate, to limit the ignorance we have and from one term to the next, to come up with some estimate of how many other life forms might be out there.
Yeah.
So
well,
that's all it is.
Yeah, because when you look around at planet Earth and see how many life forms are on this planet.
No, wait. Before you say that,
okay.
Consider that as much as biologists like to celebrate the diversity of life on Earth, as you are doing now in that sentence, the fact is, at the end of the day, you close the door and you say to yourself, all life on Earth has common DNA.
Yeah.
We are not as diverse as we tell ourselves we are.
It's like the one strand turned into a couple of hundred billion forms, but if it's true and it is panspermia, we came from the pond, originally we all came from the same single cell, everything on this planet did. And eventually it just moved out and grew and expanded, but yeah, you're right. I mean, as far as I know, we're related to everything on the planet. I mean, everything's
exactly,
related.
From yeast cells to oak trees to jellyfish to lobsters. And so to an alien who has no DNA in common with us at all, you are closer to a yeast cell than either one of you would be to a visiting alien.
Yeah.
So you shouldn't be quick to comment on the diversity of life on Earth.
No, I understand.
Because genetically, we're all basically the same.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I mean, when I meant diversity, I just meant in the way it looks when you actually look at the.
Well, account. That's right. And so we're sort of looks biased.
Yeah, yes, we are.
And but there's more fundamental identifiers for who and what a life form is than just what it looks like.
Well,
and that would be the genetic encoding of it.
I've used that argument myself about how closely we're related to everything on the planet. It's and we are too. I mean, it's just weird. You know, when I actually think about how things evolved on this planet, I have to kind of take a step back sometimes. It's just weird. And what has there been? Three great extinctions now. With the last one, three great extinctions on the planet. I'm just amazed that us humans evolved over the last 63 million years basically out of nowhere. You know, I mean, we just came from where?
But what do you mean? Who's we?
Humans. I mean, the dinosaurs went extinct. The mammals took over. The mammals grew, and eventually we came out of all of that. But I just find it odd that in the two previous life forms that there wasn't any intelligent life. They were much longer.
No, it just means that intelligence is not an important feature for survival.
Oh, okay. Well, see, that's
all that means. There are other things that are important for survival, like locomotion, mm-hmm. like vision, and vision has revealed itself in multiple ways in the fossil records and in the life tree of life. Like bats can get around just fine. They don't even have any eyes. The fly has an eye that's completely structured differently from the human eye. The octopus eye is completely different from the vertebrate eye. So sight is really useful, and it showed up multiple times. Intelligence, if it were useful for survival, it surely would have been there more often.
That's what I would
than just once. So we're deluding ourselves to thinking that intelligence is some pinnacle of evolutionary process and that any animal given enough time would evolve intelligence, when in fact some animals are just perfectly fine getting along as they've been, like the coelacanth, like the horseshoe crab, like the cockroach or variants of it. These are animals that have been very stable over hundreds of millions of years. And
why mess with perfection?
Yeah, I mean, and perfection is defined by how well tuned are you for the environment that you're living in. It may be that intelligence is counterproductive to survival, because you reach a point where you know how to like extinguish yourself, or your militaristic ways end up affecting not only your neighbor but the entire species.
Boy, isn't that the truth?
Right.
And that's the thing, and because I was always curious. It was just, you know, we had all this life, and then we had the dinosaur. I mean, they went extinct, and then we had the dinosaur era, and we had all the life there, and it just seemed like, you know, all of a sudden there's no intelligence, and then all of a sudden, you know, what has been on life on this planet? Almost 2 billion years if you go back to the single cell. And in the last grain of sand, the last 2 or 3, maybe we'll be nice and say 15 or 20 million years, a man popped up on the scene.
Primates.
Because man's only less than 2 million years.
Yeah,
and the thing about it is it's just odd, you know.
But what's odd about it? It's just another life form on the tree of life.
I know, but it just seems like and I'm not saying that we evolved was odd. It just seems odd to me that out of all the species and everything that's been on this planet over all the billions of years, it took that long for Mother Nature to decide that, oh, well, we're going to make something intelligent. And she might be regretting it now.
Well, a snake might say, well, it took this long for them to make me, snake speaking,
yeah.
who can detect prey with infrared rays.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You know, and swallow something bigger than its head.
Yeah.
You know, because the eagle is saying, oh, it took this long to make someone with my accurate vision. I mean, everybody's got a story that distinguishes something about their life that other forms don't have. So you have to watch out for the human, understandable, but still the bias that we are prone to bring to bear on who and what we are in the animal kingdom.
Well, that's just ego.
It's the same bias that wants us to distinguish, that gives us the urge to distinguish ourselves from other animals, denying them, you know, any sense of that they feel pain or have thoughts, or we want to separate ourselves in ways that are entirely artificial.
Well, I remember when I was a young man, a kid growing up, you know, people still tell me all the time, well, animals don't have emotions. And I used to look at my dog and go, I think you're wrong about this. Of course, now...
Yeah, anybody who owns pets would just completely...
Yeah, well, now they've done a billion-dollar study on it, and they found out that they do. But, you know, before that, you know, everybody was always, no, they don't. They don't have emotions. They don't form any types of thought. And actually, I had quite a few people say over in the 70s and all that they didn't dream. Of course, now we know all of that's wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so...
These are all attempts to distinguish us from they so that we can think we're special.
And granted, now, we may be more intelligent than they are, but still, there seems to be some intelligence there, and they seem to have a lot more in common with us than we like to admit to.
Mm-hmm.
All the way around. But now, what do you think is the second most intelligent species on the planet? I hear a lot of argument here, so that's why I was asking you.
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. I think whales have got to be pretty intelligent.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Given their brain size. Elephants, I'd put chimpanzees up there very high as well.
Yeah, see, that was always been an argument between chimpanzees, dolphins, and whales, which one is the smartest. And I guess it would depend what you're going to base intelligence on, the use of tools or the lack of destruction or, you know, what it is. I mean, dolphins seem to be a kind of laid-back group, whereas chimps seem to be a little bit more hyper and use of tools, so... If we go by tools, they're more intelligent. If we go by
dolphins don't have opposable thumbs.
Yeah,
so
and dolphins also been on the planet a lot longer.
For all we know, they're doing calculus problems in their head, but just don't have a pencil to write it down.
I always find them interesting because they got two additional senses than we do, and they've been on the planet 240 million years longer than us.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of animals that are sort of better equipped for survival than we are.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. It seems to put us in the thing now. What do you see? I mean, you're in astrophysics. What do you see coming in the near future? I know there's NASA's got quite a few programs in work, and I've heard European Space Agency's working on some stuff, and I'm just kind of curious to see where the field itself is going to be moving, say, over the next two decades.
Well, that's for astrophysics. The discovery path is predetermined by just looking at the budgets for NASA.
Yeah, that's
because what's the next telescope? What's the next space probe? What's the next mission? And it's these missions and these telescopes and space probes that extend our knowledge of the natural world. And in high-energy physics, for example, they wait around for the next particle accelerator to visit regimes of energy never before seen. So I have high hopes that we might find, or high expectations is a better word, that we would find life in places other than Earth, beneath the soils of Mars, in the oceans of Europa, possibly even on Io.
Yeah. Well, I'll go out on a limb and say I think we're going to find life on Mars and this century for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And so perhaps within 20 years of knowing for sure whether there's life on Mars.
Yeah, I would definitely have to go there now. You know, I was thinking about, don't we have a new telescope going up soon to find Earth-sized planets? I think is
yes.
What it was.
Yeah, there are several. But there's one called Kepler, which will be looking for Earth-like planets that move in front of the host star, and it will measure the drop in the starlight because it's blotted out by the planet moving across the surface.
Yeah,
and it's sensitive enough to measure Earth-like planets.
Well, that should really change things in itself. I mean, it would be nice. I imagine they're going to go back and revisit all the solar systems they've already found planets in. And because I would imagine, you know, some of these giants they talk about being 40 and 50 times the size of Jupiter, they've probably got moons the size of Earth around.
Well, sure. Oh, yeah.
You know, so I'm imagining they have to go back and visit those as well, see what they can find there.
That's right. No longer is it just the lone planet in the green zone. There could be moons around other planets
yep.
that are that it kept warm.
Yeah, I've seen a special on that just recently. I thought that was done quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about life forming on planets around, you know, around gas giants and things.
Well, that
like
increases
that.
The size of our net that we cast in the search for life in the galaxy.
Now, I know you've heard of SETI. So, what do you think? Waste of time? Waste of money?
No, of course not. Well, somebody's got to be looking.
Well, I agree. Somebody's got to be looking, but. For me, using radio waves is all fine and dandy if you're looking for a race on our level. You know, I really, because even up, we're starting to get away from using radio waves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going into light and everything else. So I think it's a good thing, and I actually run SETI on several computers. We actually have a group that runs
SETI at home, yeah.
Yeah, SETI at home, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have a group of us that runs it. We do a lot of, and we have some major computers running for them. But it's just, I just have doubts are going to ever find anything using radio waves.
That works until they find somebody, and then.
That's true.
So the question is, how much resources are they using? Are they redirecting resources that are such a large fraction of the total of money available for science that other science is getting that would be of higher likelihood of success is getting pinched? And that's, the answer is just simply no.
No, they're not. I agree with you.
They're a vanishingly small fraction of the total science mm-hmm. budget. And with an extremely high, it's a high risk, but extremely high return on what a positive discovery would be.
Well, I know one of the guys who was doing his thesis, he was working with the two gentlemen that found the first planets. He's working, and he's working with SETI on this, on using, on looking for, I guess, lasers. They're looking for light. They're looking for light aimed at the planet, is what
he said. The optical SETI, yeah. OSETI, they call it.
Yeah, and he said he had some interesting results. Nothing that he would say that was, you know, extraterrestrial or anything. But and I'm sure there's a lot of strange stuff out there that's going to be beaming towards our planet as well. I just find that interesting. Both of them are good, and like I said, we back and endorse SETI. We want to see him find something out there. It's just I always like to ask people because I get a big mixed review on SETI. Some people agree we should be doing it. It's not really costing anything. It's not really hurting anybody. And some people just get hostile about it.
I just don't know what argument a person would give to not do it.
I don't either. But, you know, they get, I mean, well, that's the thing, they get belligerent about it. It's not even a coherent argument. They just get mad about it. And I'm like, well, whatever. So they're not taking money away from your children or anything else. They're privately funded. And from what I understand, it's a shoestring budget at best.
That's exactly.
So
there's no... There's no cogent argument against it.
No, and
that I've
done interviews with three or four people from Berkeley over there, and I find them an interesting, well-informed group of people. I don't ask them about ET too much, other than what they're doing at SETI. But, you know, I don't want to get them started because, ooh, boy, that's a tough crowd,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Tyson. Now, I know you're going to be doing quite a few appearances in the near. Oh, you know what? Give them your website right quick so everybody knows where to go find you.
Actually, probably the easiest way to find me is just go Google Neil Tyson, and I think the top hit is going to be my website.
It is. It's your number one. He's real easy to find.
Yeah, unless, like, Mike Tyson slips in there. Just skip over that.
That's all I put in. Actually, I put in Dr. Tyson, to be honest with you, and came right up. So he was first on the list, very first one, guys. It's got a really clean website, too. It's not all cluttered like a lot of...
Well, thank you. That was recently redesigned by someone in my office, and I agree. It's very clean, because I don't like websites that are just in your face. It's like, you know, I just want to enjoy my visit. I don't want to...
Yeah, I like them clutter-free, more directed. It's a very clean website, and tell them. I said they get a fantastic job.
Yeah, I'll tell them.
Because I'm with you on that. I don't like cluttery websites. I don't like websites where things are binging and banging and singing and screaming.
Dancing and carrying
on.
Hooting
up
and hollering.
Yeah, and I don't need all of that. I come there for knowledge. It's all I want.
Uh-huh.
You know, and physics is, and astrophysics and physics are two of my favorite all-time subjects. And I'm very fortunate that I'm not like the average person. I get to talk to a lot of the big names in it, and I get a much better understanding because, you know, I'm a layman at best. And, but I call it a free education without having to spend millions of dollars.
Well, there you go. Not millions, but of course.
Well, you know, a couple hundred thousand. Yeah, my nephew paid about $400,000 to graduate Tulane. So.
Oh, wow.
And he's a lawyer, though. He made it back in those
He'll time. Make it back real
oh,
quick.
Oh, yeah, he made it back in his first year.
Out of control.
Ivy League lawyers don't. They make their money. He's an environmental lawyer, too. So.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, enough about that. But, you know, now I see you have a nice appearance list. I see you, and I've heard, too, that you're very approachable and you're very nice and you'll take your time and chat with people, and that's
well,
very
if,
nice
you know, if it. Someone's, if my specialty of study is someone's, has a, if someone has an interest or passion for it, I'm not going to deny them that access. So if I'm there and I'm giving a talk, I'll take practically every question that's given.
Well, see, that's excellent, because I have to say that's not all astrophysicists, not all physicists for that matter. Some of them are willing to come on radio shows and talk, or TV appearances, but they're not real friendly general public. And, I mean, they're nice to me because most of the time when I'm there, I'm wearing a press badge, so they're going to be nice to me no matter what. I mean, that's just how it is. But, you know, I've seen them with other people, and so I was glad when I heard it. A friend of mine had, I guess he had seen me at a book signing in New York. He's going up there. He's going to nursing school in New York City. And he had, somewhere you were at, I think it was a local library or somewhere, he said, you were very approachable, very nice. I'm mad that he's listening right now.
mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was just glad to hear that kind of stuff. Because,
okay.
Like I said, you know, I know Keiko's the same way. He'll if you give him a chance, he'll talk your ear off.
I know.
But he's great.
That's an enthusiasm.
Yeah, it is. Well, that's, y'all both are very enthusiastic. Y'all both do very good television appearances. What I like about it, and you and him both, when I see you on television and you're doing whatever special it is you may be doing, it seems like, one, you must have more say in what goes on in these things, because it's being explained on a basis that a layman can understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important, because I see a lot of science specials and a lot of physics specials that I know the average layman is not going to understand. They're going to be like, what the is he talking about?
Right, right.
But I noticed that, and I've seen you use a lot of visuals, which I like personally.
mm-hmm.
You know, but those are things I always enjoy seeing, and I'm just glad that people are actually presenting this to the way the general population can understand it. Because, you know, I hate to say this, but physics and astrophysics seemed to be a very closed society for a very long time.
I think it was. You're right. Actually, Sagan opened that up
a lot. I would agree that Sagan opened it up quite a lot, and because I always did enjoy Carl Sagan. He was another one that was very well, did a good job of presenting things on television and for the layman. And I guess maybe he was the start of it, but I see both of y'all have followed right
behind. We're in his wake, actually.
Yeah, and y'all are doing fantastic work out there, and I'm just glad to see it, because I have a big interest in science and physics, and I know a lot of my friends and a lot of my listeners have a big interest in science and physics.
Mm-hmm.
And matter of fact, when this was going to announce, because this show will air on February 11th, it'll be a sellout. There'll probably be 700,000-800,000 people tuning into it.
Oh, okay.
And the show averages 600,000 listeners.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be probably 700,000-800,000 people tuning into the show. Because, you know, a lot of people give me a hard time because they see the name UFO and they instantly get scared, but they don't understand that a lot of what we do is science-based. You know, it is. We do talk about UFOs, don't get me wrong. We do from time to time get on those subject matters, but we do a lot of other subjects, especially on the space sciences and along those lines. And I appreciate people like you coming on and talking to them about it, because it helps me to understand things better. It helps them to understand things better. It makes everybody's job better around, and it lets people know, the laymans know, that, you know, when we're talking about extraterrestrial life, we're not always talking, oh, ET's coming to your house and dragging you out down the street or whatever. We're trying to get the point across to people that we're probably not alone in this universe. And you know, we're using science to help them to understand that, look, even science agrees that we're going to probably find life out there other than us.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to open it up because I want to see more money going to space sciences and space exploration. And the only way I can see that happening right now is if you get the people involved in our country, and the only thing I can see getting them involved in our country right now is the search for ET. Because right now our country seems to be in this just doldrums, I guess is the best way I could say it, polite way of saying it. You know, I mean, I meet a lot of youth these days, and I get a lot of phone calls from youth, and it just seems like they're it's not that they're not as bright or anything like that, they just seem to be maybe bored, might be.
Well, the country's not engaged in a activity that
there's nothing to get their imaginations going, I guess,
yeah,
is what
right.
I'm trying to say.
That's right.
But thanks to you and a few others, there are some people out there keeping the interest going, but I would like to see our government get involved, take a more active role in waking up our society and saying, hey, guys, look.
So that's what happened in the Apollo era. So
yeah.
We just need another big mission such as that.
Well, that's what inspired me to get into electronics was the NASA astronauts. It's what got me to join the Navy. That's where I got my original degrees, and when I got out, I got my bachelor's out of the Navy. But it was because of watching these guys that I wanted to go learn this stuff,
mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know, now I own a construction company, but still, you know, life has a funny way of turning things around on you, but I always have a keen interest in almost all the sciences, especially space exploration and physics and on quite a few other things for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important for the youth to get involved. And you know, I know you have children, so I know you know what I'm talking about. Now, do you want them to follow in your footsteps, or?
I have no such requirement of them.
Yeah, you just
wherever they want to go.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's how mine is. My son asked me what I said. It's whatever you want. You're a grown man now. You just go do what you want to do in the world. Make your way in the world. I said, you don't have to follow. And I said, the business will be yours anyway when I pass away, so don't worry.
Right.
But it's just one of the things. Now, where was it? I wanted to see, where is their next appearance at?
Oh,
I have the list in front of me, but I think I set it down.
I don't keep track in my head. It's just whatever's listed there.
I was just trying to give them an idea where to... you know what? I thought I had it on your site here. Give me a second. I'll see if... Yeah, there it is. Upcoming appearance. Look at that. Look at that. Boy, this is a clean...
I tell you, it's clean. I'm telling you.
I love this site. Okay, Monday's already... Oh, Wednesday, New York, Daily Show. Oh, okay, Jon Stewart, huh? Well, that's a television interview. Okay. February 2nd, Madison, Wisconsin, Wisconsin Theater. Oh, lecture series, huh? Boy, you are one busy sucker.
Well, when the book comes, because the Pluto Files is out.
Oh,
right,
that's
now.
True. Yeah, that's right. All right.
So there's a book tour related to that.
Well, it looks like you're going to, ladies and gentlemen, he's going to be in New York, Wisconsin, Los Angeles, San Francisco, back in New York, Texas, Washington State, Mass, Philadelphia, Dallas, back in New York. Best thing I can tell y'all is check out his site. Find out where he's going to be. That way, if you want to go see him, you can go see him. Get an autographed copy of the book. That's another thing. Tell one of them to mention that. It's a very clean written book, guys. They got some good illustrations in it. He's got some good photos in it as well.
We have Pluto book.
Yeah, the Pluto book.
I think it's just a fun romp through.
It is. It is. And it's. I like it because I don't have to wear my glasses to read it.
Okay.
I got to be honest about that. But you got some excellent illustrations in it as well.
Yeah, it's intended to be fun to read, but still nonetheless extremely informative about the past, present, and future of Pluto and all the controversy that surrounded its promotion.
And guys, what's important is it's not an intimidating book. It's not a huge book. It's an easy to read book, and it's an easy to understand book. It's you're not going to feel like you're back in college trying to learn physics again. Let me put it that way. He presents it very well, ladies and gentlemen. I have the copy right here next to me. I would advise everybody to go out and get a copy, check it out, read it for yourself. I think you're going to enjoy the book. You know how I am. I rarely promote a book, so y'all know how I am.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've been hosting this show for 8 years. I think I've promoted a total of 6 books.
Mm-hmm.
Now I let other people come on and talk about their books, but it's because I got to be honest, I don't find that many books I like anymore. Occasionally, I run across something I like, and
a lot of books are a chore, actually. And
they
I want to make sure when I write a book that it's not. I try to make it what I don't like in books to prevent it being from what I don't like.
But judging from the way I've seen you speak, you know, I mean, that's why I knew the book was going to be pretty good. I mean, because you're a very eloquent speaker, and you know, I think that just to be honest with you, I think that transfers over into the book.
Okay, thanks.
And y'all should get out there and get it. I mean, I know the show's not going to air on February 11th, but y'all should get out, get the book, check it out. It's easy to read. It's not huge. I think it's 160, 170 pages, somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a light read for most of the readers that I know that listen to this show. So go check it out, guys. I think y'all are going to enjoy the book. And on his website, he has a list. Actually, in the book itself, and y'all might want to get it just for this, in the book itself, he has a list of a lot of the other things he's done. Guys, he's got an impressive lineup, I have to tell y'all. Some of these I've read, some of them I haven't. A couple of them I didn't even know you wrote, so I'm going to go to...
Oh, you mean books, previous books?
Yeah, previous books.
Yeah, they're all actually still in print, so you can just dig them out if you're interested.
Can you get them on, like, Amazon?
Yeah, sure. In fact, my website has easy links to them, but otherwise just dig them out of Amazon.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, because, you know, like...
And, you know, Amazon cross-links you. You put in a keyword, and it gets you every appearance of that word in the whole universe.
Yeah, Amazon is great for that. I see you have Universe Down to Earth. That was your first one, or...?
My first book was Merlin's Tour of the Universe, but then it got transferred to another publisher and then appeared in a later printing. So it doesn't show up first, but it is the first book.
Okay, yeah, cause I see it's got it listed as 97 in here. Yeah, I see what you're talking about. Just Visiting This Planet, what is that about?
That's a sequel to Merlin's Tour of the Universe. It's a question and answer on the universe.
It's
very playful and informative by this pen name, Merlin, who's been around for all of time.
Mm-hmm.
You ask Merlin, dear Merlin, I don't quite understand gravity. And Merlin sort of recalls a conversation in Isaac Newton's backyard with Isaac Newton, and the answer comes out that way. This is part of a column that I wrote for about 10 years for Stardate magazine.
Oh, well, I'm going to get these to you. This sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's all there. It's all, is what we're trying.
And I'll have to get these two and read them, and I'll probably have to tell them to call you back after I read them. And then I see you got One Universe, At Home in the Cosmos.
Yeah, it's a large book. I have two co-authors there.
Yeah, I see that. All right.
And it works great as a coffee table book, but it's really intended to be read. But it's highly illustrated. And it organizes the contents of the universe not by object, as so many textbooks would, you know, stars, planets, galaxies, universe. It organizes them by ideas, by concepts. And it's a much more challenging task to organize a book around concepts, but our goal was to explore how much deeper we can connect you to how the universe works, rather than just as an inventory of its contents.
Well, this one, because I think I've actually read that one. I have to make sure. I have to go look in my library because we have a huge, huge library. Even though Katrina claimed half of it, I did have managed to replace about half of it. Yeah, I lost about 540 books in Katrina, and but quite a few of our friends and publishers that we
worked
with.
The levees, took out the books.
Yeah,
I don't blame the hurricane.
Well, I don't either. I don't blame the hurricane either.
I actually
think the hurricane served a purpose, to be honest with you. So I'm not quite as critical as everybody else is. I wish they could find a way to tone them down a little bit, but
but it was already toned down when it hit landfall.
It was
Category 3. The hurricane had already passed through. People were sweeping up the street. Then the freaking levees broke.
Oh, yeah, it was ridiculous what happened.
Right.
And at first they said it was this, that, and the other thing. Well, I was home 2 days after the storm. I actually did a live broadcast from New Orleans the Wednesday after Katrina. And 2 days after Katrina, we were down here doing a live broadcast. What I found interesting was, at first they said all this BS, and then come to find out what really happened. They left that barge in the canal.
Mm.
The barge smacked into the side of the wall, and, of course, once that happened, it started leaking in. You know how water is, once it gets a little crack, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger until it's too late. And then next thing you know, all of Lake Pontchartrain is in the city of Metairie in New Orleans. That was just ridiculous. But hopefully, with new administration, they'll work on that a little bit harder.
Right.
You know, I hear good things, so we'll see what happens. And let's see what was next. Cosmic Horizons, Astronomy at the Cutting Edge.
Yeah, those are actually, I was a co-editor of that. Those are contributions from others are at the leaders in... on the frontier of various subjects, and that's a compilation of the articles on the frontier of all aspects of the universe.
Now, this one I've also been through, too, Origins, the 14 Billion Years of Cosmic Evolution.
Right, that one is...
That's an excellent book, by the
way. Sweeping survey of how the universe got here, and as well as the stars, planets, and galaxies, and that is the companion book to a PBS four-part series that I hosted called Origins.
Yeah, which is, that was a different, I was thinking of My Favorite Universe, sorry, getting them confused there for a minute. And then you got the one, The Sky is Not the Limit.
Right, Adventures of an Urban Astrophysicist, that's my memoir.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll definitely read that, because I've read four out of the ones on there, so I'll have to go back and see them. Because I honestly didn't know where, I guess my local library don't stock everything you have. I'm going to have to get on their butt about that.
Well, you better get on their case.
Oh, I will. Well, they're real good about it. If you request something, they'll put it in the library.
Oh, good.
And especially if it's not, garbage. They really, really prefer when you come in and ask them for something substantial to put in there.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, they're limited in how much they, I guess they're just limited. They go by request. And since Katrina, they've been repopulating the libraries down here. So,
right.
And a lot of people right now are just in the storytelling, so there's just a lot of garbage in them. I shouldn't say garbage, but it's just a lot of fantasy stuff and no real science of any. You got to go up to the city and go to one of the college libraries to really get anything hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
But, that's changing. And as like I said, as long as we request stuff, they'll get it in there and go. Now, there was one other thing I wanted to ask. Now, I just totally lost track of where I was going here. Now, the Pluto Files is out, right? I mean, it's already
It came out in the last week of January.
Yeah,
so
that's what I thought. So, yeah, it's out this week, yeah.
That's correct.
So, ladies and gentlemen...
In fact, it came out yesterday is the official release date.
Okay, so y'all won't have any problem finding this book.
That's right, it should be everywhere, yeah.
And what was it, 1995? Or was that... No, that was another one, wasn't it? Oh, I had it right in front of me, too. Well, it's on the site, guys. Y'all can go find it. I'm going to tell y'all this again. I want everybody to go try to get this book and urge it because we're getting down to about 5 minutes now. But, Dr. Tyson, you've been fantastic, by the way. I've loved crisscrossing topics here with you, but I wanted to make sure we got in all your books so everybody knew about
them. Well, thank you. But the current one is the Pluto Files.
Yeah, the Pluto Files is the one we're talking about today, ladies
and gentlemen.
Everything
you never wanted to know about Pluto is in that book. and including actually, Disney the dog, the Disney dog. It's all in there.
Yeah, yeah. I was getting ready to tell him there's a few other things in there.
Mm-hmm.
Jock and Coach. I don't want to give away any spoilers here, but there's a couple things in there y'all going to find interesting. And really, truly, he does everything you need to know about Pluto is in there. I mean, it's definitely in there. And this takes away the argument what Pluto is. You know, we now know it's not a planet, okay, guys? And stop writing nasty emails. I'm sorry for y'all Pluto lovers. It's not a planet. Come on. It's not even a... What is it, about the size of... It's bigger than one of Mars' moons.
Mars' moons are barely even that.
Yeah, I don't even know why we call them moons. Aren't they just two asteroids orbiting?
They're two potatoes.
Yeah.
They look like Idaho potatoes.
Yeah, there was one I remember seeing. Russia lost a probe at one of them, and that was one of the weirdest pictures I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
It was rounding the... I don't know what it was. It was just rounding the moon. You could see it coming around. And there was a flashlight, and it wasn't no more probe.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everybody can try to make some conspiracy out of it. It was just some dumb thing, but it was really weird. When you watch it, and I couldn't believe Russia even put it on the net where you could see it. I was just amazed. But, I forgot which moon. It was Ganymede, I think, it was going around. And it was just, you could see it as it arced around the moon. It was just like it looked like a streak of light. More than likely what it was some type of meteorite or something, or a micrometeorite streaking across the surface, you know, coming around the surface of the asteroid, smacking the thing. But, you know, there was a lot of conspiracy theories about it. I was just laughing. I'm like, I don't think so, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Mars is cursed. I'm not going to argue the fact that we have a hard time. Everybody on the planet seems to have a hard time getting stuff to Mars, but...
We've been lucky lately.
Yeah, so. But, you know, I think people forget, too, what kind of challenge this actually is.
Right.
You know, sending stuff to the moon is not that big a deal. It's, what, 214,000 miles away?
240,000, yeah.
240, yeah. So it's basically a hop, skip, and a jump from Earth. But Mars is quite a big, quite a long distance, and there's a lot of variables that can come into play. And then I know on that one probe, they just, what was it, they set the finder was done in metric when it was supposed to be done in standard.
Oh, the thrust of the vehicle was... There was a mix-up between the thrust in pounds and the thrust in...
Oh, is that what it was?
Right.
Yeah.
Metric versus the English units.
Yeah, that's just one of those things. But it's not a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen. Just sometimes things happen. But, yeah, we've been very lucky in recent years with things there. I've been quite impressed with the rovers, I have to say.
Yeah,
they went way past their life, that there was a life expectancy. They found some interesting stuff. I've just been really impressed. And I have to say, I think... The money they spent on it was well worth it.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, granted, they didn't find, you know, E.T. walking around on there, but I think it did a damn good job. And I like stuff like that. I'm easy. Okay, you can stick a probe anywhere and let me watch it. I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a happy camper. I love stuff like that. I think that's just what doing what we're meant to do. For me, humans seem to be explorers by nature. You know, I mean, especially Americans, because, I mean, everybody living in America was either kicked out of Europe or left their own country, but basically they're some type of explorer. So, you know, I think it's in our genes, and I think it's for our society especially, it's a need. We really need to be challenged, and we need to challenge ourselves and our youth and everyone else for that matter, and, you know, and keep people interested, you know, because really, right now, our country, not just our country, but there seems to be no direction anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just seem to be just muddling along.
Yeah, there's no global mission statement.
Yeah, there's nothing.
Right?
And
mission statement.
Yeah, I would like to see something. I mean, anything. You know, something that got everybody in the path, got people fired up and inspired about their leadership and about what's going on in the future. And, you know, I'm in my 40s, so I mean, I only got X amount of years left on the planet, but I got kids and grandkids and great-grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to see them really enjoy life. And a lot of my grandkids have a big interest. They really, really enjoy it. Matter of fact, most of them excel at it quite well. I think I'm at two of them are going to end up going to college, probably to get into physics.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have a knack for it. You know how it is. You either got a knack for math or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And you really need to know your math if you're going to be in physics. Now, what made you decide you wanted to be an astrophysicist? I mean, was it...
I was 11 years old. I've been known my whole life.
You just looked up in the sky one night and said, this is what I want to do?
With binoculars, yeah.
Yeah.
It helped a couple of years earlier having visited the Hayden Planetarium on a family trip. Hayden Planetarium, local planetarium here in New York, which I'm now director of course. But that would normally make a great story, you know, in a small town, but in New York, no one pays attention.
But still, it's got to be. I mean, it's got to be satisfying for you, though. I mean, as a young man, you this is what you want to do, and you visited the planetarium, and now you're the big boss at the planetarium. And I mean, it's got to be rewarding.
Well, nature's my ultimate boss, actually.
Well, yeah. And I know, you know, we're limited by weather, what we can actually see at night. And
hence you have satellites above all the weather.
Yeah, that's nice. And you got Hubble up there now, too.
Exactly.
Somebody was telling me they were using Hubble as a spotter for the really big eye. The big telescope down in South America. I can't think of the name of it.
Well, there's several.
Yeah, well, no, it's that the newest one. It's supposed to be the biggest one they built. I can't remember it. Something eye. I always want to call it the really big eye, but that's not what it's actually called. I wish I could remember what it was. But I had read an article, it was about a year and a half ago. They said they were using the Hubble as a spotter so that this thing, they would use the Hubble to find what they wanted to look at, and then they would use the telescope on the ground to look at it.
Well, that happens often.
Okay.
The coordination between, because not all telescopes are equally as good at doing the same thing.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And so you can use one telescope to discover the existence of an object, and then another telescope to follow up on that.
Yeah.
We have a very coordinated, we have a very cooperative community in this regard.
Well, that's excellent. Actually, most astronomers I talk to seem to be, they're friendly with each other. I don't want to say they're friendly with everybody, but a lot of them are standoffs, I have to say, but a lot of them are really nice, nice people. But they do seem to be well-organized and have a good group.
Yep.
And you know, I know people get confused because they hear us talk sometimes because, you know, there's astronomy and then there's radio telescopes, and there's actually quite a few ways to look at the sky these days. And I know when people hear, they hear astrophysicists, they're like, oh, well, he's like an astronomer. He just looks at the sky through a telescope. Well, no, that's not exactly true.
Right. More to it than that. Today.
Yeah, I think you go a little bit further than that. But y'all use the radio telescopes, and do you do any of the, I forgot what you call it, too, the spectrums, when they're doing the different light spectrums?
Well, when you analyze an object today, you want to know all you can about that object. If that object, if there's a particular object of your affection. And so you'll use a regular sort of visible light telescope, but you'll be also interested in what radio telescopes say about it and what ultraviolet telescopes say about it and infrared. So if the object is speaking to you in all of these bands of light, you're going to want a telescope watching what it has to say. And so the best studied objects are those where all means are brought to bear on what the object is doing.
Maybe somebody should do a CD of the different sounds of the universe. I have a clip of Saturn that is just wicked sounding. It is wicked sounding. We use it. Matter of fact, we use it as break music between the shows. It's a one-minute clip, and it's NASA had released. Actually, there were several of them NASA had released, about 11 or 12 of them. But this is just, it sounds like something like out of a 50 sci-fi movie. People write to me all the time, what is that? I said, that's Saturn, guys. And they're like, where can I find it? I said, oh, you can go to the NASA site. They got it there. It is wicked sounding. And it is now, for you, what is your favorite thing? I mean, for your favorite discovery or just in general?
I like wallowing in the ignorance of not knowing what dark matter and dark energy is.
Oh, now, you just had to grab a big one there, didn't you? I heard, as a matter of fact, at Tulane University, just really, they had a physics discussion. This was more like a physics argument on Einstein's theories in dark matter. Do they actually apply? And actually, they called it the dark universe. Does it apply versus the light universe? I got a little confused there for a little while, and then I realized what they were talking about.
Well, it's a frontier, so yeah. It opens itself up to a lot of speculation about what it could be.
There was, NASA had released something about 8 years ago saying that gravity acts different in certain areas of the universe and talking about dark matter. And I was kind of floored by that. And then, of course, the layman's took off with it, meaning that it meant something other than what it meant, because I don't think anybody knows what it means at this point. And then I had seen that study where they were, oh no, that was antimatter they were trying to contain. Never mind, sorry, wrong thing. Yeah, I had seen where they were trying to contain antimatter, but they couldn't keep it but for a couple of milliseconds. Do you think that's a good idea? I mean, is that something we should be trying to do at the limited technology?
I think any frontier is worthy of exploration.
Well, I'm always scared they're going to blow the planet up.
They said that about splitting the atom 100 years ago.
That's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean,
they
said that about everything that science ever does.
Yeah, that's the argument right now, to keep hydrogen stations off the roads, which is just ignorant, but... I've been hearing that argument a lot. Oh, we can't have hydrogen stations. They're going to blow up. No, they're not, John.
we have gasoline stations.
That's what I'm saying. We got a gasoline station on every corner.
Right.
I don't really see how it's going to be that. I think people hear the word hydrogen and they think hydrogen bomb, and it's not the same thing. And it needs. I really think
hence
that
the need for a scientifically literate public.
I agree. I agree with you. And at the very least, I think our government should put some kind of program out there to help educate Americans on hydrogen fuel, because we got to do something. And that's as good as resource as anything else. I mean, come on, it makes clean water.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really ask for much better than that. And it'll take a billion years to flood the planet. So by then, I'm hoping we have a new technology. But Dr. Tyson, I got to tell you, you've been fantastic. I know we're just about out of time now, but I want to tell you again, you did a fantastic job. I had a great time talking with
you. Well,
thanks.
Thanks for having me on.
We're going to actually have your book posted to the site today. They'll stay up till probably about a week after the program airs, which will be February 11th. So. And I will mention your book a couple more times on some of the other programs upcoming on my program tomorrow night when I'm doing the show.
And you've got a copy of it there. So
yeah, I got a copy right here. And I've been keeping it next to me because I've been using it. I was talking with a friend of mine out of Florida. He's a physics professor down there at Florida State. And we were actually discussing some of what you said in here. But I'm not going to get in there because I'm getting ready to run out of time. But
okay.
Again, I want to tell you thanks for being on. You were fantastic. Hopefully, I'll talk to you again in the near future.
All right. Ladies, good luck with the show.
Yeah, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, be sure to get the Pluto Files. You're going to really enjoy that book. Again, guys, I want to thank everyone for tuning in today. This show will air on February 11th. And until then, have some fun, smile, enjoy your life. See y'all Wednesday. And